So we will hear from Clayton in a few minutes from this podium, and then I'm going to take myself out of the conversation as City Club are non-biased, non-partisan. We brought in a ringer today to do some of our question and answer. So after Clayton speaks, Dwayne Deskins will sit down for questions, and you'll meet Dwayne in just a minute. He's a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Attorney's Office. He was first assistant here in Chicago, in Boston, in Los Angeles, and in Cleveland. So he brings a little bit of expertise that I may not be able to bring to this conversation. I really look forward to hearing Dwayne and his moderating of this conversation, which he will also then do in a very similar format and very similar questions and topics with Eileen next week. So some of these questions, by the way, have been pre-submitted by other civic groups. And if you have any questions, please get them down now. There are papers on your table. Sooner the better. Write your questions down, and we'll bring them up a little bit later in the conversation. So Clayton Harris, he's a candidate, as you all know, for the Cook County State's Attorney. He's an experienced prosecutor, government leader. He's managed offices in the city and state levels and everywhere in between. He was a prosecutor in criminal appeals, traffic and special prosecution, narcotics under former state's attorney Dick Devine. He worked in the City of Chicago's Office of Intergovernmental Affairs team before becoming counsel at the Chicago Department on Transportation. At the state level, Clayton has significant management experience, having served as chief of staff of IDOT and chief of staff in the governor's office. Most recently, Clayton served as executive director of the Illinois International Port District. He also teaches in his spare time policing race in America, black, white, and blue at the University of Chicago. I'd like to sneak into one of those classes. That'd be interesting. Maybe we'll have a City Club field trip. So if you would, please join me in a warm welcome, City Club welcome for Clayton Harris. Thank you, sir.
We good, Mike? All right. First and foremost, honestly, thank you all for coming out. I appreciate you all being here. I'm looking forward to having this discussion on this extremely important race. So thank you to the City Club. Thank you, Dan, Dwayne. I'm looking forward to having a lively and engaging conversation, and I'm grateful to be here to talk, and truly I am humbled by everyone in the room coming out to hear about this important race. So my name is Clayton Harris III, and I'm a Democrat, so let's start there. I am a Democrat, and I am running for Cook County State's Attorney. Let's just put it plainly. We'll jump right into this, and we'll talk about some other things. The future of safety and justice in Cook County is on the line. We got to talk about it. We need to address it. There are a lot of important races on the ballot next week, but in my opinion, there's no more important race than this one right here and right now, and that's for state's attorney here in Cook County. Our criminal justice system is at a crossroad today, all over the county. From Skokie to Chicago Heights, from Maywood to the Mag Mile, people do not feel safe. Too many people don't feel safe in Cook County, and too many others don't feel like the justice system is set up to work for them. But we can address both of those, and we can address both of those by holding everyone accountable appropriately and by continuing moving forward on the important work of criminal justice reform. So I'm running. I'm running for folks who feel like that they are scared to come downtown or to take public transportation. And I'm running for the people who have been pulled over through pretextual traffic stops. I'm running for the businesses that feel like they need to close up or to shut down because of smash and grabs or the crime that's going on downtown. And I'm running for the people whose wages have been stolen or the communities that feel like they have to look over their shoulders because of hate. I'm running for all of us, and I'm running because we can be safe and just at the same time. It's not an either-or proposition. It's an and. I get it. This is personal to me, too. all of us. My wife and I, we live on the south side of Chicago in Washington Park, and we're raising our two little boys, 9 and 11. We have to worry about bullets flying. We live in a neighborhood where we hear gunshots. More and more of us are starting to live or work in areas where we hear gunshots, so we need to address that. But I have to worry about gang violence and bullets from the 2 minutes it takes from us walking from our front door to Washington Park. But I also have to worry about walking back from Washington Park and us being profiled by the police. Neither of those are safe nor just. I learned the fundamentals of safety and justice at Howard University School of Law. There I learned that a lawyer had to be a social engineer or they were a parasite on society. And some people have asked me, what does it mean to be a social engineer? So briefly, a social engineer is a highly skilled, perceptive, sensitive lawyer who understands the Constitution of the United States and knows how to explore its uses in the solving of problems of local communities and in bettering the condition of underprivileged citizens. Charles Hamilton Houston. I apologize for not still having that memorized, Giada. I know I was supposed to. And Tanya, I know. But soon thereafter, after graduating, or right before graduating from law school at Howard, I was recruited by Richard Devine. Dick Devine came and recruited intentionally from Howard Law School. What they said was, we have an issue with race, not in Cook County, not in Chicago, but in our office. I absolutely respected that. Dick Devine said in order for us to address this problem that we were going to have more attorneys of color. So I believed in the mission of the office, of the state's attorney's office, and that's why I came. And that's why I want to come back. I came to the office in 1999, and I was inspired to get inside the system and to try to address justice from inside. And we had a lot of work to do. And we have a lot of work to do to address injustice as well. I can tell you a story about my very first day going to 26 in California. I was already an assistant state's attorney, and it was my first day going to be in narcotics. I had just finished traffic court the Friday before, and I got pulled over. And the officer said, I asked the officer, I'm like, why'd you pull me over? He said, you blew the light back there. I said, no, I didn't. He said, yes, you did. I was like, I'm not here to argue with you. And I was like, but I didn't. So he asked for my license and registration, and I cautiously reached in my back pocket and pulled out my badge. I knew I had a badge back there, but I pulled it out because that's where my license was. And he asked me about my badge. He took it. They ran it. Everything came back. I still got a ticket, which is funny to me, but I did. But what I'm convinced about and what I'm trying to point out to you is I'm convinced that I walked into 26 in California that day as an ASA and not a defendant because I had a badge. That's not safety, nor is it justice. And these are the things that I bring with me, a lived experience, as I'm standing before you, putting my credentials before you to be your next Cook County State's Attorney. As an ASA, I saw the system up close. I prosecuted tough cases in the narcotics division. As you heard, thank you, Dan, I started in criminal appeals, traffic. I jumped over to narcotics and ended my time in the state's attorney's office in special prosecutions narcotics. This is where we took on violent, dangerous offenders, the ringleaders of operations that were causing and wreaking havoc in our communities. It was the right thing to do. And we're going to have to do that again. We have to focus on the problem of crime as well as addressing the issues that crime bring up. I also saw, though, at that point in time, how we were focusing our resources in the wrong places. We were focusing resources on low-level nonviolent offenders who were spending way too much time locked up awaiting trial. Meanwhile, I watched some of these gang leaders and other folks with means that would post bond and be back on the street within hours of having committed a crime, be they violent or not. And this has stuck with me. And that experience in my time in Special Prosecutions Division instilled in me the need for strong leadership and management that understands safety and justice and focuses on the real threats to our communities, like the carjackings, like the gun traffic, like the gun violence that's going on, and other people that are committing violent criminal acts. This is what has led me to my policies. And hear me when I say that. I am presenting to you policies, not statements. When someone says something, ask them, well, what does that mean? when we sit here, Duane, if there are issues or things that I've brought up, ask me what it means, because I think that's fair. I'm not going to just pander to you all and tell you things that I think you want to hear or tell you things that, you know, make the room feel comfortable. What I'm going to tell you is what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and why we're going to do it. And if you don't agree with me, that is absolutely fair. Then we can have a conversation. That is what adults do. This is how we move forward together correctly. This is what I've been teaching for the last 15 years. I've been teaching at the University of Chicago, and currently I teach policing race in America. I understand the need for community relationship with law enforcement. I'm an expert at it, so I know that we can do it because I teach it. We have got to repair a relationship with law enforcement in order for us to move together forward. I will get buy-in from law enforcement and community leaders about the best path forward. It's not a one-size-fits-all plan for every community. What's happening on the Mag Mile differs from what's happening in Chinatown or Inglewood or Mount Greenwood or Maywood or Cicero or Niles. So we have to be smart on how we approach crime here in Cook County. This is why I've already met with law enforcement entities. I met yesterday with the West Suburban. We've met with the South Suburban. We meet with everyone. This is how we move forward, is we sit down and have a discussion. As an aside, and I know Joanna's going to be like, stick to the script. As an aside, when I went in there and sat in there, one of the police chiefs said, I heard you speak, and I didn't like some of the things you had to say. I was like, all right. I hadn't even said hello yet. I was like, okay. And I was like, well, what did I say? And he asked me about it. I was like, well, I'm going to tell you the same thing I told you then. And he said, well, why? You're in a room full of chiefs. I was like, because I'm not pandering. Same thing I said to you. I'm not pandering. I was like, but let's talk about it. And it was about the $1,000 and $300. If we talk about that, I think that's a fair discussion for us to have. But during these conversations with everyone, I make sure that everyone talks or understands that there are over 130 other municipalities outside of the city of Chicago, and they all deserve attention too. So during these conversations, I tell folks to expect to hear from me a lot, not just during election season or when I need their support and endorsement, which is how I've earned a lot of their support and endorsement. They need to know that they need to know, and they need to trust that someone hears them and will continue to listen to them and engage with them. Now we're facing a particularly difficult moment as our country when it comes to violence and bigotry. In the past year, we have seen hate crimes increase by more than 121% in our county. And that's why I'll create a hate crimes data dashboard focusing on racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, to all of the phobias and racism that we have here to the public. We have to be mindful of what's going on when we talk about hate and rhetoric, and not to say something and then to go back and to try to clear it up. Sometimes it's the impact of our words and not the intent of our words. And when I say that, that is trying to and kind of letting people off the hook a little bit. But we need to be mindful of what we're saying. We need to be mindful of the dollars that we're accepting in our campaigns and what that says. So we are going to continue. As we put the data forward, we will be transparent in what we do, how we do, and why we're doing it so that we can direct resources to the right places correctly. I will develop a comprehensive system on collecting and reporting hate crime data, and we'll use this data to identify trends, hotspots, and potential areas for intervention, but not just on hate crimes. Told you all, I'm a professor, data matters. We do have to deal with two different things in this race. We have to deal with facts and feelings on what's going on. I do not discount or minimize either of those, because if people do not feel safe, we have to address that. But we also have to be true on the facts of where we are, so we can do more than one thing at a time. That is my platform, that we can do more than one thing at a time. I'll work with the Chief Judge to expand community courts, making sure that our prosecutors are present in the communities. There is a difference between being in a community and being part of a community. The way you are part of a community is you don't necessarily have to be from the community, but we try to be intentional about the communities in which we serve, making sure we're not there only from 9 to 5 doing prosecutions, but that people recognize us and see us and know that our goal is the same thing as their goal, which is a safer community. I'll draw on my experience in the private sector to build relationships with business community leaders, investing in public safety, ensuring that businesses are safe and staying here. So, Dan, I appreciate this opportunity to meet and talk at the City Club so you all can hear me and ask me the questions instead of looking at false campaign negative ads that are coming about me. That's safety, but we need to talk about justices too, and then we'll sit down. Justice is not a lock them up and throw away the key. We know that that doesn't work. This is why the Pretrial Fairness Act and the end of cash bail are important steps forward. We don't stop there. We continue to move forward. This ensures that we're not criminalizing poverty. I look forward to implementing the enforcement of the law, and if there are problems that we encounter, I'll be the first one heading down to Springfield to address them alongside with the advocates and law enforcement leaders. I can do this because I teach this. I teach public policy. In the implementation phase, which is where we are, the thing that comes right after that is evaluation. So we look at how this is working. We look at the data, and we make sure that there are not any unintended consequences. And if there are, then we go down and we fix those. We tweak the law as it is. I learned this skill from John Dunn, who happens to be sitting in here, when I was in the mayor's office in intergovernmental affairs. Cook County is the second largest prosecutor's office in the country. This office has done and will continue to do big things. I remind people that this is the office that prosecuted John Wayne Gacy and Hadiya Pendleton's killer. But it's also the office that has vacated more than 250 wrongfully convicted, innocent people that were taken from their families, that were either tortured, coerced, or deceived into convictions. We have to do more than one thing at a time. We can focus on safety and justice at the same time. People want their state's attorney to make sure that they're safe. I get that. I'm there. But people need to know that their state's attorney is focused on justice as well. So we need talented attorneys in the office, coming to the office, and staying in the office. We'll double down on recruitment and retention efforts, and to do that, we'll need resources and strong management. I have this history. Currently, the office is just shy of 750 attorneys, plus 100 investigators, and over 400 staff. I've managed an office of over 5,000 people. This office covers, like I said, more than 130 municipalities, including the city of Chicago. And I've overseen the infrastructure departments covering the state, but I've also run this state, the entire state, during a time of crisis. Make no bones about it, this office deals with crisis daily. Daily. And you need someone who has the experience to manage something on a large scale. And I have that. My background running major government offices, city agencies, and the leadership that I have and expertise is the judgment that this office needs. And Dwayne, right before you come up, let me talk briefly about judgment. Now we have to talk about my opponent and her judgment. The revelations about Eileen Burke's role in wrongfully convicting an 11-year-old black child were heartbreaking. They were heartbreaking for me to read. Let me tell you why. As I said before, I have two sons. They are 11 and 9. This 10-year-old could have been my son. It is extremely personal to me. I thought of them when I read this. I thought about them when I read of the facts of the case and what was going on and the coerced confession. And then the comments about a whole new breed. This could have been my son, a whole new breed. We can get into this, Dwayne, but this is what I'm saying. This is why this is important. So when we talk about this, mistakes made, you know, if that was it, maybe, you know, like that, you know, it was back in the 90s. A lot of things were happening. There was a lot of exculpatory evidence that was ignored. I think there were a lot of red flags. I've been in situations where I had to dismiss cases because I wasn't comfortable with what was going forward. This was not seen in this case. But since then, there's been a doubling down. That's the big problem that I have, that there's not been an acknowledgement that something was wrong. We know that this kid was wrongly convicted. We know this. But there's been a doubling down, and that's a problem. We have to move forward in this office. We have to move forward, and we cannot go backwards. And that's what I'm worried about here. It's neither safe nor just when someone is wrongly prosecuted. It's neither safe nor just. So we all make mistakes, and we can own up to it. But that's what you'll see as me as your state's attorney. Someone who's not afraid to say, hey, mistakes were made, and this is how we go better. This is how we do better, and this is how we become better. We need to expect more from our elected officials, and you all need to expect more from me as your state's attorney. And that's what you will get.
So let me say this right from the get-go. I'm not here to talk about politics. There are better qualified people in this area, God knows, to talk about politics. I'm here to talk about and help you to be actually clear, to understand the office and the suitability of the candidates for it. That's it. Everything else I leave to others. One of the things I wanted to talk about, just to kind of make it an easier start, is Mr. Harris, if you had to pick three words, just three words, because we're running short of time,
sure,
to describe the qualities of a good prosecutor, what would they be?
Understands justice. I'll give you two.
No, just three.
No, that's what I'm saying. Understands justice.
That's it?
That's it. That's okay. The good quality on a prosecutor. They understand justice.
So I want to talk about your vision of how county prosecutor's office fits into the larger ecosystem of government and private. So you have cops, courts, and prosecutors. You have mayors, governors, county officials, business, and philanthropy. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, I often see it as monetary policy, that when things get hot as they are in our economy, inflation goes up, you have the Fed. Fed makes it a little bit harder on all of us, but to quell things from being too hot. Then you have the rest of the government, and that's they come in with fiscal policy, all the jobs, all the money, all the bodies, and business as well. That's how I see them play, but that's my impression. What's yours?
So my impression is, through the lens of the state's attorney's office, it's always an administration of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And how people define justice is important. So it's incumbent upon the state's attorney to define justice. So when people are like, well, there are too many smash and grabs that are going on, when law enforcement is like, we're not being backed up by the state's attorney, when the public says that they're afraid to go outside or whatnot, it's incumbent upon the state's attorney to let them know that we are seeking justice in all of these. And the definition and the statement has to be the same. There has to be consistency on it, but there has to be an explanation on how this definition of justice addresses how you feel safety, addresses how the communities feel, addresses how businesses feel. I think that that's fair.
One of the things that you mentioned about is how you joined the prosecutor's office. You graduated from law school in 96 and you joined the office in 99. When I first became a prosecutor, I never wanted to be a prosecutor because I knew that in law school, back in before God was young, that black men were the majority of defendants.
Correct.
I didn't even take criminal law. That's how not present I was for that conversation. But I wondered what got you into it, knowing that the majority of the people you prosecute are going to be black men. I mean, no question. What got you into it?
So I graduated in 99.
Your bio information,
right.
Sorry.
Probably the same reason you didn't want to go is the reason why I did want to go.
Okay.
Because there are too many. It's the same reason why I'm teaching the course that I'm teaching right mm-hmm. there. So in order for us to address the issues that are going on, or this problem, it's a problem, then I felt like, for me, it was best to do it from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
The assistant state's attorneys and the state's attorney themselves, they have the most power in that courtroom. They decide who gets charged. They decide what cases move forward. And then they ultimately decide at least a recommendation on sentencing and what's going on.
Right.
So I think the influence and the power of the state's attorney are extremely crucial in how we address that aspect of our criminal justice system.
So then you left it in 2003. Is that correct?
Correct.
Why did you leave?
Well, part of the reason why I left was seeing that, you know, we're just churning black men in and out of the system at that point in time. So I went out. I worked on Mayor Daley's intergovernment affairs, and we worked on crime legislation. So we worked on what was initially common sense gun legislation. This is what ultimately led to the assault weapons ban. I'm very proud of that. Mm-hmm. The reason why we're doing that, though, was because of the gun scourge on black communities. So that was a different way to look at it at that point in time. And then every step that I've taken, and make no qualms about it, for this job, for someone to be successful in this job, they need to be multidimensional. They need to understand the law, absolutely, but they need to be able to manage a large office. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to lead a large office. Right. They need to understand how to get resources to come back to this office. They don't need to just have one level of expertise at all. They need to have multiple levels, and that's what makes me uniquely qualified. But the same reason why I left is the same reason why I'm going back.
Okay. So let me then turn to that. You know, and you mentioned that in your remarks, that people are really urgently seeking results. They're less interested in hearing about a policy as they are the bottom line, like what will happen during your tenure. So you know that over the past 10 years, 35,000 people have either been shot or killed in Chicago. 35,000. And five times the homicide rate of New York, three times that of L.A., and it's been that way for two decades, if you believe the University of Chicago. Robberies and thefts are on the rise. Carjackings and thefts are 233% up since 2019. Retail thefts, since the change in the retail theft laws by the prosecutor currently, 94% increase. Downtown shootings are up by 220%. Mag Mile, I learned this yesterday, the other day at the City Club. The Magnificent Mile accounts for one-fifth of all the jobs in Chicago. All of them.
And it's a $2 billion annual industry.
Exactly. And the Harris poll found that 40% of city dwellers and 54% of suburbanites do not want to come downtown because they are afraid. What results? So what are the bottom line results that the public can expect from you during your first year? And I know that before you answer, there's always, and it took a long time to get here. It's going to take a long time to bring it down.
No.
You can build a building in 3 years. You can knock it down in an hour. I think people need to know what they can expect.
Right. I'll tell you the same thing. And we were successful at the Illinois International Port District. I'll say the same thing I said there. The three-year contract that I had there, I was like, we're not going to have the ship turned around, but you'll see it moving. So my first term in these 4 years, you'll see what's going on. What I would say that I'm going to have to do, again, is to address facts and feelings in order for us to do that. So I'm going to challenge you on a couple of the facts that you said there, because there was just a report last week that said that, you know, retail theft was down 13%. Here, while it was up 60% in similarly situated municipalities. And we've seen some of the other gun crimes decrease. Those are the facts, but we still have to deal with the feelings, because you're correct. If people do not feel comfortable coming downtown, mm-hmm. or walking outside, mm-hmm. so it's real. So we don't just sit over here. So what we have to do is make sure, as your next state's attorney, that I'm doing more things like this, that I'm on television or in the media and letting people know that we are doing more than one thing at a time and that we are focused on people's safety. So we will let people know that, you know, when we have broken through child pedophile rings, that people know that we've done that and we prosecute them. The other day, you saw the press conference with the prosecution of Ella French's murder, mm-hmm. right there. This is important, that people understand that we're focused on safety and justice at the same time. Mm-hmm. So communicating what's going on to try to change the narrative of what's happening, mm-hmm. is important. People need to know, when I tell you I live in Washington Park, that's not, statistically speaking, a safe neighborhood to live in. We're not going to leave because we're not going to be pushed out because of wrongdoers. What we're going to do is
I have to push back a little bit on you, because I asked you for where are we going to be. So if you're elected, where are we going to be after year one? Where are we going to be after year two? I mean, do we see a steady, like when I was a kid, the grade was the thing.
Sure.
You have to get a certain, well, you know, I'm trying, I'm doing all the inputs. They want to know, bottom line, where are you going to be? So where are we going to be on homicides and shootings and carjackings and thefts? After your first year, your second year, steady progress, where are we going to be?
Well, I think then we have to talk about the role of the prosecutor, mm-hmm. right?
We talked about.
Well, we're right. But when you say, where are we going to be on homicides and everything, you know, this is, you said, an ecosystem. So these individuals have to be apprehended and arrested. Mm-hmm. And then once they come in, then we prosecute. So what we're going to do is, like, you know, we're going to have conversations so that I say, hey, you know, last year there were 100,000 arrests that were made. Out of that 100,000 arrests, 87,000 of those were sent and accepted by the state's attorney's mm-hmm. office. Out of that 87,000, 82,000 of those move forward in some way, shape, or form. We have to give them the facts, but I can't tell you that as the prosecutor that I'm going to be able to bring down homicides. What I can tell you as the prosecutors, when cases are brought to me appropriately, that we will move forward with prosecuting these. I think what will happen, or help, thank you, I think what will help is when people understand what we're doing, how we're doing it, why we're doing it, and that they see that there is a certainty in the prosecution. We're going to hold everyone accountable appropriately, but to put homicides and robberies and thefts on the shoulders or of the state's attorney alone, I think that's an improper assessment to try to have, especially through like a one-year.
Well, I'm going to pivot to that now. So do you have a strategic plan? You announced 7 months ago that you were going to run. Do you actually have a strategic plan in somewhere that people can read that will tell them, and this is just a yes or no, I'm going to get into more detail, but do you have one?
Yeah, yes. I'm a public policy professor, so we're putting policies together. Okay. So how we address that is kind of what I spoke to. We address that first and foremost by beefing up special prosecutions.
No, I mean, do you have a plan? I mean, right now that they can read, the public can read.
Yeah, we beef up special prosecutions okay. where we focus on organized crime. Right. Focusing on organized crime starts to tackle the carjackings.
We're going to get to that. I'm just wondering, but you do have a plan?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to talk about that, so don't think we're going to get away. You mentioned now, and the current prosecutor mentioned as well, that, you know, the police don't bring me cases, so I can't very well prosecute. And yet, if all of us looks at the current landscape, the prosecutions that are being led against Donald Trump, and whether you like him or not, are being led by prosecutors, whether it be in Georgia, whether it be by the Department of Justice. Those are the people leading the charge. So when you say, oh, I'm waiting for them to come to me, no one's waiting for the FBI or the Georgia State Police. They're leading it. Who in your office is going to lead on putting those kinds of cases together?
Well, I will.
In Chicago and across the
country? No, so I will. Okay. And my assistants will. But again, we're not pointing fingers, and we're not going to point fingers at anyone. We're going to work with everyone so that people understand that there will be a certainty of prosecution when these cases come. So I'm not pointing fingers at law enforcement. What I'm saying is when we get these cases, mm-hmm. we're going to work them up. To the cases like with Trump, though,
saying work them up. I'm asking, are you going to be out there saying, I know that the old block gang is out there. I know that they are causing violence. I'm going to have a task force out there to work with all the various law enforcement departments to focus on their criminal and violent activities so that they don't hurt and kill people. That's what I'm talking when I say leadership.
Right, but that's leadership in the police department. The leadership in the state's attorney's
office. Right, so I'm talking about yours.
That's leadership in the police department. Yeah. Leadership in the state's attorney's office is backing up that leadership. So okay. working with them as they come through. I am not arresting people. What I'm doing is taking the cases right. when people arrest. But one of the things that we can do, and this is leadership right there, is I have a policy that we're going to bring forward, a community engagement unit. This community engagement unit will have four units under it. We'll have a community engagement team. We'll have a youth engagement team. We'll have a hate crimes engagement team. And we're working on the policy if we put sexual assault and domestic violence engagement team. So to your point about the folks on O Street and that are standing there.
No, it's O'Block.
O'Block, yeah. Right. And what we do is we look at youth engagement right there and find ways to keep these youth engaged okay. in there. And we work with law enforcement through these. But there is the authority of the state's attorney, and then there's the sphere of influence. And I talk about the sphere of influence, and maybe this is what you're alluding to or getting to. I do think that the state's attorney has a larger influential area that they can do. It wouldn't necessarily be going in to arrest these individuals as opposed to providing resources to go in and to stop these individuals from ever coming into. So we deal with diversion once someone has been arrested, but we can work on deflection so no one ever gets arrested. So instead of standing out there, right, waiting for something bad to happen, we're engaging them first and foremost. We can talk about classrooms. We can talk about chessboards.
That's fine. And I think that people get the thrust of what you're saying. Let me talk a little bit about, so one of the things we've established, you do have a plan, and we talked about how you intend to lead on that plan. But I'd like to talk then about, are you the right person to do that? And one of the things I know you've heard in this race is about experience. You have rock-solid experience in the legal world in terms of government affairs and legislative affairs. 20 years of doing that. But it would be also equally true that if you are elected, you'd have the least Cook County prosecutor criminal court experience of any prosecutor in the last 30 years. 30 years, going back to 1992. So my sense is, do you think that you are, not just in terms of general management, but that you're up for leading this kind of task? And I wanted to get your response to that criticism.
Absolutely. I mean, that's plain and simple. Right. But when you talk about the criminal experience, you know, I mentioned that, you know, what gives me my bona fides is this is what we're talking about right there. Having come through narcotics and special prosecutions narcotics, no one should sleep on that or being able to be elevated to that level in the amount of time that was there. So look at the criminal. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though there's a civil side and we talk about juvenile. So, no, my opponent does not have the same experience that I have in criminal. So that's one thing. So I wouldn't be the one with the least amount of criminal experience. But if someone is relying on strictly the legal experience or the time in the office as the bona fide on whether they should be the next Cook County state's attorney, then they grossly misunderstand the role of the state's attorney. The state's attorney is not going to be the one in the court making an argument. The state's attorney is the one that makes sure that the ASAs who are in the court have the resources they need, have the training necessary, have the background and backup that they need. You need someone who can lead the office as well as manage the office and understands legally.
Oh, I understand. I was a first assistant, so I get the job. But I just wanted to—this is not to question me. This is actually for people to illuminate on you. There is, you in your plans to reduce violence, you talk about going after gangs and offenders. Are you going to have multi-defendant cases instead of just the one, you know, one judge, one defendant cases? So the Oblock case involves six defendants, six. Does the Cook County Prosecutor's Office and the Cook County Courts, do they do multiple defendant cases like that? Do you know?
It depends on the facts. It depends on...
No, conspiracy or RICO. Do you do those cases?
It depends. I could say yes without knowing the facts, or I could say no without... We've tried multiple cases.
Can you name one multiple defendant case that the circuit courts have done in a gang case?
I cannot.
Okay. I think the reason is that, and that's what I found, is that they don't. It's one case, one defendant, and not because conspiracy could be that whole table. You're going to have one judge with one person, one judge with the next person, one judge with another person. That is not an efficient use of your time. Again, I'm not sure you would agree. But let me switch that.
Well, before you move on, it depends on the facts of the case. It depends.
I'm saying conspiracy.
I understand with the conspiracy, but you might have one defendant that's working with the feds. You might have another defendant that's strictly on state. Mm-hmm. It depends on what's going on at that point in time. So it might not be appropriate to have all of them going at the same time under the same judge. So for me to say yes or no on that is, again, it requires the facts of the case before I make a blanket assertion. And I think that's what everyone should want in their state's attorney is someone who's going to look at all of the facts of the case before they move forward.
Absolutely.
One way or another.
Let me ask you a little bit about something that's really in your wheelhouse, and that's legislation. As you know, there's a law currently on the books in Illinois that's going to expire this year that increased penalties from 3 years to 6 to 7 for aggravated use of a gun and unlawful use of a gun by a felon. Do you favor continuing it or having it sunset?
I think that we should continue on with it, but there are tweaks and things that we need to look at it before we move forward. So I'll sit down with legislators to see what makes sense. I'll sit down with advocates and groups.
But what do you think?
I think that we need to be aggressive when we prosecute crimes committed with guns, but I think we need to also recognize there's a difference between a crime committed with a gun and a crime committed and someone has a gun. Those are two different things. Also, when you look at the UUW statute, correct? You can be charged with unauthorized use of a weapon. You can be charged with UUW with just ammunition and not have a gun. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to move forward the same way in prosecuting someone that might just have ammunition as opposed to someone who has a gun, or as opposed to someone who has a gun and there's gunshot residue that's recently. So we need to use every tool available to aggressively prosecute cases that are involving individuals that are doing harm to our communities, but we need to be smart on the prosecution.
To be sure, I don't know too many cases where people are throwing bullets at people. But
that's,
my sense is that I think
that's dismissive of what I'm saying.
I want you to talk about gun crime.
People have been caught committing a crime,
sure,
and then they've had ammunition on them and not a weapon, and then they're charged with UUW.
Absolutely.
So what I'm saying is, being smart on the prosecution, is that we might not prosecute this person under UUW the same way, sure, we would prosecute someone with a weapon.
Okay. There is a, I want to talk more about, you mentioned that you guys are short of lawyers, and morale is certainly low in the office. Felony review division is down lawyers, as you know, and that makes it fewer lawyers to handle more cases. And in one in particular case I want to talk about that's gotten a lot of news, I'm sure people here know that, and I know you do, that the prosecutor's office reviews search warrants.
Correct.
And they review them for legal sufficiency and accuracy. So I want to talk about Anjanette Young and a woman who was raided by the police because they didn't do the proper amount of legal work to verify the information from their informant and determine the accuracy. As an engineer, you know that there's levels of redundancy. So it's not just the police and their supervisors, but then they bring it to your office if you're elected, and your lawyers are supposed to do a thorough and independent review of that search warrant, and then it goes to a judge. With the shortages that you have, and I will say that search warrants are down by 90% since 2019, how are you going to make sure those kinds of errors do not happen?
Yeah, we don't cut corners. We continue to review and do what we're supposed to do. I've signed off on search warrants when I was an assistant state's attorney, and there is redundancy in there. So just because we're down staff-wise, that's not an excuse. We don't make excuses in the state's attorney's office. We do the work that's supposed to be done. So we don't cut corners there. I know Anjanette Young. She and I go to church together. She's endorsed my candidacy, and what happened to her was a travesty, and it shouldn't have happened because there should have been checks and balances there.
So how are you going to make sure that, at least as state's attorney, that there are checks and balances within your office to make sure that your church member or other people's church members aren't affected by that?
Well, we do this by managing. You know, I have to hold the supervisors in each one of these departments accountable for what's going on in and with the line ASAs in there. We can talk about training if that's necessary, but this is a management issue. We have to hold everyone accountable. And then the excuse will never be that we don't have enough people. That's why this search warrant got approved incorrectly. That is not what we are going to do at all, ever. We don't cut corners, and we manage and we hold people accountable for their actions inside. If I'm going to hold people accountable appropriately outside of the office, if I'm going to hold police officers accountable appropriately outside the office, then we're going to hold everyone inside the office accountable appropriately as well. The reason why I'm here too and today and we're taking questions or whatnot is because you all are supposed to hold me accountable as well appropriately for everything that I do. So if something like that happens, mm-hmm, under my watch, you hold me accountable for it. Because I'm supposed to hold my supervisors accountable. No. It shouldn't happen.
Right. And I bring it up because I don't think any of us heard anything like that during that whole process. It was all police, 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 and, oh, by the way, the police. So I want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned about building trust in the community. And you also, quite frankly, mentioned that the fact that the homicide, especially against black folks, you know, according to our friends at the crime lab, and again, you can check with them, it's the highest level in 20 years. that if you look on a per 100,000 basis, it's the highest it's been in 20 years and 40 times higher, 40 times higher than for white folks in our county. And of the top five most dangerous, I guess, in terms of homicides and shootings, Austin has 115 per 100,000. Garfield Park is 146 per 100,000. And Tijuana, Mexico, the most dangerous city in the world, is 138 per 100,000. I mean, I think people with 88% chance of being arrested on a homicide and 95% chance of not being arrested on a shooting, I mean, people are afraid to come forward and to assist you because they're afraid of retaliation by the people who live in their neighborhoods, and rightly so. How are you going to deal with the issue of witness protection, that these people don't have to feel that by raising my hand, I have signed my death warrant?
Yeah, we have to make sure that we're working again. And I talked about this, about our relationship with law enforcement, but this also comes with working with the chief judge to ensure that the proper resources are placed in the right places, especially for witness protection. So we need to make sure that our victims advocate, the groups and the unit that we have inside this office is staffed up, and that we're putting the correct resources so that people know that they're going to be safe coming forward.
When you say resources, what do you, give me an idea what you mean.
Money. We need to make sure that money and the right people are in the right places to ensure that these witnesses are protected and are we're able to utilize them. We know when people speak with law enforcement in their communities that their communities are safer.
But isn't that your job, though? So the prosecution has the witnesses. The judges don't. They try to keep even hands between the defense and the prosecution. If I come forward prior to indictment, isn't it your job to protect me as a witness?
Correct. That's what I said.
That's not to do with the chief judge.
We work with the chief judge on witness protection to make sure that we can place them in protective custody or services. So we have to do that with law enforcement as well, so that we're protecting the witnesses. So that they will continue to come forward and do come forward, that they're safe.
All right. I wanted to ask a little bit more, if I could, just about what you think. No, I'm not going to. Let me switch to a different topic. There was a question about how you define restorative justice. Somebody wanted to find out if you compare yourself to the current prosecutor, is, first of all, what is your definition, and do those definitions do they vary?
Okay, I'm not 100% sure how she would define it correctly, how I define restorative justice. When we look at the restorative justice community courts, what we're doing is we're utilizing individuals from communities that are taking individuals that have harmed communities from that community. And we're talking about nonviolent or low-level offenses or whatnot. And what we're doing with these courts, or what they're doing, is ensuring that there is some type of restoration, not only for the victim and the community, but also, so when I talk about the offended in the community, but also the offender, so that they can return and be a contributing member to their community. So it's a 360 process where everyone's involved. I think the most recent study that came out said that there should be more community involvement there with these courts. So the way I look at it is that we need to engage our community. I mentioned before about the prosecutors and being in a community versus being part of a community. So when I look at restorative justice, what I'm looking at, or what I feel, is that what they're trying to do is make sure that these courts are part of the community. We should expand these intelligently from where they are right now into other areas, and we start where the areas with the highest amount of crime, where they could do the most. So I think that restorative justice focuses on complete repair, first and foremost with the victim. We can never lose the victim in sight of what we're doing, even with the attempt to restore the community as well. So the victim, the community, and then the offender as well.
I realized the question I wanted to ask you, and I apologize. It's a little out of order. So I want to return back to search warrants. Right now, if you were going to get a search warrant, you were a law enforcement officer, would you know where to go? Which judge to go to?
With the law enforcement officer, no. You'd have to ask the law enforcement.
I'll put it a different way. Is there a judge who is assigned on a rotating and random basis, so part of that redundancy, to actually take and review that search warrant as we sit right now?
There are judges, but it depends on when. So there are times when it would be late at night and you have to find a different judge or a judge that was available to approve. So
what I have seen from coast to coast is that there is a judge. So that person is on duty, just like you have lawyers on duty. That judge is on duty all day. The next day, the next person's on duty. So you don't have to have cops picking a judge who's a friend or otherwise to do it. And that's something where you could work with the chief judge. Would you be willing and commit to these people to work to make sure that an independent judge reviews search warrants?
I have zero problem with that. I mean, any administration of justice is what we're going to focus on. So if it's that only one judge reviews search warrants all day long, that's fine. But any judge that's reviewing a search warrant, it still has to come through the state's attorney. It should come through the state's attorney, and we're going to be reviewing that. So no matter what judge it goes to, that they will have the proper evidence.
Right.
The proper information to make an intelligent decision.
I just want to make sure it's clear. I'm not saying that it won't go through your office. I'm saying that your office can't pick which trial judge you have, and no should a cop be able to pick which judge the search warrant should have.
I don't have a problem with that.
That's something where the chief judge could really be of major assistance.
Sure.
Okay. I think that, Dan, we have way exceeded our time. Are there any other questions from the audience? Dan, or those people have... note cards?
No, I think you received one.
Yes.
Unless the others are here.
Yep.
We'll probably close in just a minute.
Okay, thank you. Excellent. So if you were elected the prosecutor, what would your stance be on police pursuits? What would be your view of public safety, law enforcement safety, and criminal system rights? I mean, there's a balancing there. It's a dangerous job, as you know from the Ella French case. It's a very dangerous job, that and others. How do you balance that, I would say, is the part two, and then the part one is how do you deal with different jurisdictions in terms of police pursuits?
So, you know, this is going to be the general orders from the police and what's going on. And truly what you're weighing, right, is public safety versus public safety. Mm-hmm. If there's a search or a pursuit that's going on, right, I'm assuming that they're pursuing this individual because of their public safety concerns. But during that pursuit, we also have to look at the public safety and the concern for the public safety as it's going on. What I'm going to tell you is that what we'll do is back up law enforcement correctly with what they're doing and following and making sure that officers are held accountable for following their general orders on what they're supposed to do right there. But that that is law enforcement.
And then one last question, and I don't mean to belabor this, but I think it's a really good question. Would you support legislation that would enable the Attorney General's office to investigate and prosecute public officials and police cases, public corruption? So right now, and I know you know this, statistically, Chicago is the most corrupt city in the United States, has been for a while, in terms of just indictments, charges. Bridgeport, right? And I wanted to ask, statistically, if you look at cases brought, and also gang violence, what efforts do you think you want to make in those areas in terms of doing public corruption cases? And also gang cases.
Sure. The goal, my goal, being the Cook County State's Attorney, is always going to be one of safety and justice.
Mm-hmm.
Public corruption is not just. Teach about that. We deal with that or whatnot. Gang violence, it's not safe. We have to remove pride out of anything that we're going to do. So if it's appropriate for my office to move forward with public corruption cases, and we do, the state's attorney's office does take on public corruption cases, then we will. Gang violence, obviously, through criminal aspects of the office, we handle that, and we will. if there are issues or areas where the Attorney General feels like he or whoever is the Attorney General at that time might be able to do a better job and secure a conviction in public corruption cases, then my pride is not going to make me step in and to say, no, we're going to do it. I will work with anybody and everybody to make sure that we're all safe. And safety comes in a lot of different levels. So we can talk about the criminal pursuit. We can talk about civil pursuit. We can talk about elected officials, appointed officials, or anyone. My goal is that we always maintain our focus on safety and justice. And at the end of the day, when all is said and done, that we are a safer society because of it. And that hopefully, you know, maybe not just year one, two, three, four, but all 8, 12, 16 years that I'm your next Cook County State's Attorney, that every year there's a metric that you can measure and say, damn, we're glad he was in there.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Clayton. Thank you, Dwayne. There is no doubt, if anyone had any doubts, we had two prosecutors on the stage today. Thank you for answering the questions. Thank you for thoughtfully asking the questions. We don't take these elections and these issues too lightly here at City Club. And we will do the same on Monday. We welcome everyone back to that program with Eileen O'Neill Burke, and we will have plenty of other programs coming. I hope you all got a glimpse into what Clayton Harris is all about and what he would plan to do if he wins this race. Thank you again for being here at City Club. We hope to see you all soon. Thank you, Clayton. Thank you, Dwayne. Have a great day.
Thanks,
to our group. Thanks.